designed for those low frequencies. So that's good. Something that we could play with that. Okay. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome.
Okay, so we'll now talk about high frequency propagation. Let's see, this is a pretty large, let me just get a number of pages here. Okay, we'll talk about this and then we'll stop, because after this then we'll go into UHF and VHF, but we'll save that because this will probably take up the next half hour or so. So high frequency propagation. The high frequency range between 3 and 30 megacycles is the most interesting, unusual, and variable part of the radio spectrum. This is known as the shortwave band. And basically, that's what we're operating on, shortwave band. We could divide this section into the spectrum of the... We can divide this section of the spectrum into three parts. 3 to 10 megs, 10 to 20 megs, and 20 to 30 megs. Each part has distinct characteristics, although there is some overlap because of day and night, seasonal, and sunspot variations. Before considering each section of the shortwave band, let us mention some of the general characteristics of shortwave signals. And, of course, they show another illustration here. Let me just read this a second. All right, because they're referring to the illustration, which I can't show. So it just says, as shown in Figure 10, the radiation angle is very important in long-distance transmission at these frequencies. Now, as Mark knows, he mentioned before, I'm active on 75 meters. I've been playing around on that since the summer. And I used to operate on 10 meters. 10 meters had an interesting propagation. And there was something called an MUF, which is the maximum usable frequency, which actually I used to know, but I got to look it up again. They might mention that in this book later on, what the MUF is, because that changes. But I remember hearing that, and this goes back to the 70s when I was active on the 10-meter band. But I've been playing around on 75. And that's in itself an interesting band of what happens between day and night. So, as I just mentioned, the radiation angle is very important in long-distance transmission at these frequencies. Low-angle radiation provides the most useful long-distance signals, while high-angle radiation often goes through the layers and does not return. The sky wave and ground waves never overlap, so there is no fading area. The range between the end of the useful ground wave and the start of the reflected sky wave is called the skip zone. Within this range, it is usually not possible to pick up the transmitted signal. This is the reason that a shortwave station broadcasting a few hundred miles away cannot be heard, while a European station thousands of miles away can be picked up quite clearly. So, and we're not talking about the broadcast band, which is the, the medium frequency wave. We're talking about HF now, so it's got different propagation. So we could hear broadcast stations overseas easily, as this points out. The vertical angle of radiation of the transmitted signal is important in directing a signal to the specific location on the Earth, on the surface of the Earth. Likewise, the choice of frequency is important in being able to direct as strong a signal as possible in the specific receiving location. Consequently, the international broadcasting or in long-distance point-to-point communications, the correct choice of frequency is of great importance. frequency signal which, when directed straight up at a right angle into the ionosphere, will be reflected from a particular ionized layer and returned to the Earth, is referred to as the critical frequency. I'll just repeat that. So the highest frequency signal, which when directed straight up as a right angle into the ionosphere, will be reflected from a particular ionized layer and returned to the Earth, is referred to as the vertical, as the critical frequency. For the D and E layers, this critical frequency is usually between 1 and 4 megacycles. And of course, we're operating between that range on 75 meters because we're operating on 3 megs or so. So we're right in that band. If the F layer, or I should say in the F layer, the critical frequency may be as low as 2 megacycles during the night and periods of low sunspot activity, and almost as high as 15 megs around noon during periods of high sunspot activity. Yeah, which we experience as the sun goes up. We can, since I'm on 74th, I can tell the difference in the propagation. It changes. They call it the band goes long or the band is short on 75, depending on if it's nighttime or daytime or what have you. Signals higher in frequency than the critical frequency will pass right through the layer if they strike it at right angles. However, if they strike it at some angle less than 90 degrees, they may be refracted or bent by this layer. Now again, you gotta like visualize what I'm saying here, the way I'm reading it, so you get an idea of how this propagation works on this band. So, instead of measuring the signal angle in terms of the angle at which the signal strikes the layer, the usual procedure is to measure the angle between the signal and a line drawn from the point where the signal strikes the layer to the center of the Earth. This is called the angle of incidence. Of course, you know, that's also true when we're dealing with light. Thus, if the signal strikes the layer at right angles to it, this angle will be zero. That makes sense. At some value greater than zero, the higher frequency signal striking the layer will be refracted, not reflected, this is refracted, so the signal will return to Earth. This angle is called the critical angle of incidence and is... It's shown there's an illustration here of what that looks like. We actually show the phase angle, and which is they call it, there's a Greek letter theta, which is that's the phase angle theta, and they call it that. The critical angle of incidence and the high angle radiation into space, the ionized layer, and so on. So, this may be a little bit hard to visualize, but that's the best way I can describe it right now. But just keep following with me and we'll understand all this. The angle at which the signal leaves the antenna is measured between the signal and a line drawn parallel to the surface of the Earth at the antenna and is called the angle of radiation. And that's theta number 2 is also shown in this particular diagram here. For a lower angle of radiation, and again shown by this illustration, we get a greater angle of incidence, and the signal returns to the Earth at a greater distance from the antenna. Thus, For effective long-distance communications, we need a low angle of radiation. And that's exactly why we don't want a near-vertical incidence antenna where the where your signal is going up to the sky. We want the signal to go out to the horizon. We want a very low angle of radiation. So when you guys put up your antennas, you got to make sure it's a certain distance above the Earth. You know, height. Height makes all the difference. Because you don't want your signal to go straight up. You want it to go out to the horizon. So this basically explains that and shows it in this diagram. Alright, let it drop. Okay. So continuing. The highest frequency that can be returned to the Earth at a specific distance is referred to as the maximum usable frequency. So there we go. I said it before, MUF, maximum usable frequency. Okay, and that varies. We were playing around with that on 10 meters all the time. So I'll say it again. The highest frequency that can be returned to the Earth at a specific distance is referred to the maximum usable frequency for that range. This maximum usable frequency, abbreviated MUF, is higher than the critical frequency and must enter the ionosphere at an angle greater than the critical angle. Okay, so again, you have to see this, we're dealing with angles here. But again, ladies and gentlemen, just bear with me because we'll get through this and maybe get a basic understanding of what's going on, and that's what this is all about. Frequencies above the maximum usable frequency will not return to the Earth as the prescribed distance. I should say not as, at. So I'll repeat that. Frequencies above the maximum usable frequency will not return to the Earth at the prescribed distance. A frequency lower than the maximum frequency will be attenuated because of the greater atmospheric absorption. Thus, the lowest usable frequency to cover a specified distance is one that will provide a received signal of sufficient strength and will not be attenuated to an unintelligible level by atmospheric absorption. Okay, now, what we were just talking about was that first segment of, and I have to go back here because this is, let me just see here, where I mentioned it. Okay, this is when I mentioned the HF band is divided into three parts. This is 3 to 10 megs, 10 megs to 20 megs, and 20 to 30 megs. So this is what I've been talking about is the first part. So this is between 3 megs and 10 megs. This particular range. Let me just see here, propagation in the three. Okay, so this next segment will be a discussion on the propagation in the 3 to 10 meg range. Let me let it drop. Okay, so they're breaking it down now into the three separate ranges that I just mentioned. Propagation in the 3 to 10 meg range. For daytime operation, the low end of this band between 3 megacycles and 7 megacycles is excellent for transmission up to a few hundred miles. The nighttime range can be 1,000 or more miles. At the high end of this band, between 7 and 10 megs, the daytime range will often extend to almost 1,000 miles, while at night, and especially in the winter, coverage can be thousands of miles. At the low frequencies of this range, summer static is often severe, but is less than the higher frequencies. Yeah, the static is, you get a lot of lightning and everything else that we hear on HF. and other types of static also. In this range, the E layer dominates in the daytime, while at night the signals are reflected by the F layers, which extend the transmitting range. In general, high angle radiation provides good coverage for short to moderate distances, low angles for long distances. Okay, so the next segment is the propagation in the 10 to 20 meg range. The range of frequencies is used, or I should say, this range of frequencies is used by most of the international broadcast stations. The frequency is high enough to penetrate the E layer and is reflected from the F layer during daylight hours. By using low frequency propagation angles at the transmitting station, it is possible to get worldwide coverage. Furthermore, by controlling the transmitted beam with a highly directional antenna, of course, very strong signals can be beamed to one part of the world. During a sunspot maximum, this band of frequencies can send signals into some parts of the world at any time of day or night. During a sunspot minimum, the nighttime performance is more limited because the high frequency signals penetrate the thinner ionization layers readily and go out into space. Thus, at certain times during the night, long distance signal reception is poor over a large part of this frequency band. Okay. Now we're going to talk about, just to reiterate, that was the propagation in the 10 to 20 meg range. So now they go on and talk about propagation in the 20 to 30 meg range. Now I'm getting used to not timing it out now, which is good. Okay, so propagation in the 20 to 30 meg range. The 20 to 30 meg range is used for both local and long distance work at certain times. Local communication is by ground wave and is very reliable. The range is limited to about 20 miles. The high frequency portion of this band is used by public utilities and police for mobile radio. Yeah, right. No longer the police operate down there. They used to. Remember your old shortwave radios, your AM broadcast band radios and so on? Used to have said police on it. I remember those slight little dials that actually said police on the, if it had a shortwave band on it, it would say police. Stand by. Okay, because they're taking advantage of the ground wave effect. So during times of high sunspot activity, stations in this service sometimes interfere with each other, and mobile units thousands of miles apart will often make direct contact. Yeah, just call the cop who's 1,000 miles away in his car, and he would answer you. All right, long distance communication. Oh, by the way, this is, you're listening to Andy's Corner, W8-2-CDL, is my call. Okay, hold on a second, let me turn this other radio down. Okay. All right, long distance communication by sky waves is limited to times when the F layer is almost dense. During maximum sunspot activity, this band of frequencies is good for long-range operations day or night. During a sunspot minimum, daytime communications become spotty, and no long-distance communications are possible at night. The low-frequency part of the band is used for international shortwave broadcasts using the skywaves. Okay, so that is how the propagation works on the 20 to 30 meg range. Basically, that covers the whole HF band, you know, high frequency band, up to 30 megs. Again, VHF starts from 30 to 300. Anything above 30 megs is designated as a VHF band as opposed to HF band. Okay, so now we'll just talk about fading and propagation. Okay, fading and propagation disturbances. When there are a number of possible paths for a signal to take between the transmitting location and the receiving site, there is always a possibility of fading. Multipath transmission generally means that there is always a small time delay or a slightly different travel time for each wave propagating between the transmitting and receiving antennas. The relative phase relationship among the arriving signals determine the net signal strength, and the two signals may add together or they may cancel each other. You probably heard that when you listen to, so you know what the fading is on radio stations when you listen to them, or any high frequency, and you're operating HF and you lose the signal, then it comes back, and you lose it and it comes back, and that's the fading. And these are the disturbances I'm talking about. The relative signal amplitudes may also vary with respect to each other. The net signal strength will increase and decrease over a period of time, resulting in either a rapid fading, which is flutter, or a rather lengthy fading cycle. And we get that all the time on 75 meters. There's quite a bit of fading. The usual radiation from a broadcast station, either local, regional, or international, occupies quite a range of radiation angles. Thus, it is possible that signals can be reflected from differing levels in the atmosphere and arrive at the receiving antenna over more than one pass. Again, time differentials among the arriving signals may cause fading. Since the modulated signal is composed of various sideband frequencies, it is possible that some sidebands at a given instant are additive and other sidebands subtractive. This causes a distorted output from the receiver and is referred to as selective fading. And that's a term that's always used on 75. You've heard of selective fading, so that's exactly what causes it. The effects of fading are often minimized by using a system called, and you're going to like this one, diversity reception. And that's actually using two separate receivers and two separate antennas at two different locations. That's what it is. It'll explain this. In such an arrangement, two receiving antennas are spaced 5 to 10 wavelengths apart. So you can calculate the wavelengths or the frequency you want to hear. The frequency you want to hear, and you can get an idea of how far you want to space these antennas, and supply signals to more than one receiver. And they show a diagram of that. So you got the transmitting antenna, you got receiver number one, receiver number two, five to ten wavelengths apart. They're both connected to the same speaker, so now your selective fading becomes minimized. There are receivers that do that. In fact, what's nice about some of the SDR radios is you can have more than one receiver. I think even more, you have your SDR is set up there. I think you could you can compensate for selective fading by taking two receivers and connecting two antennas, because you have provisions for that, and you can minimize that right in your receiver already. That's the advantage of all this digital stuff, right? Am I right about that, Roy? I believe you can.
KC2GS, you are absolutely positively correct. I do it pretty much at least every Sunday morning for the Kings County Radio Club 10 meter net. I listen to my vertical with my left ear and my horizontal with my right. And occasionally people will come in from places like Florida and they'll discuss just general fading with me, whereas I'm listening to them and I hear their signal going from my right ear to my left ear to my right ear to my left ear. So what's really going on is Faraday rotation is varying the polarization angle, and since they have a fixed polarization angle at their end, they're just seeing it as a fade.
Yeah, very good. There was a an article in QST years ago by KK7T, Rick Campbell, C-A-M-P-E-L-L, and he made a receiver, and I forget what it was called, using a very interesting scheme. Now, I'm trying to remember what the name of this receiver, Minoral or something like that, which gave an interesting effect because of the phase difference. It uses phase shift circuitry and going from the receiver, changing the phase, and then bringing it into an audio amplifier. So you have a one channel on the left side and your headphones and one on the right side, and you get an interesting effect. Something, got to look up that article. You did something like that. Okay, of course it's not exactly what we're describing here, but it was something similar. All right, let me, we're almost done, and it's just about 9:30, so I'm right on schedule. So, getting back to this diversity reception here, as I said, you got two antennas spaced 5 to 10 wavelengths apart and supply signals to more than one receiver, as shown in the diagram. The receiver outputs are then fed to one speaker. Signal levels are smoothed out by using this arrangement because at any given instant where there might be a fading on one antenna, there could be a signal addition at the second or third antenna. Therefore, an intelligible signal can be received for a higher percentage than the total reception time than with only one signal antenna at the receiver. I've never actually played with diversity reception, but it would be interesting to, if I ever get myself an SDR radio or something, my boy has, to be able to play with it, because we do get a lot of fading, for sure. Selective fading, that's a common thing. It's a common phenomenon on 74. Okay, we're almost done here. In addition to the very decided influence that, In addition to the very decided influence that sunspots have on wave propagation, there are other factors that influence, to a lesser degree, signal strength, fading, or polarization. The Earth's magnetic field and any variations of that field can influence signal strength and polarization. The influence of auroras, the aurora borealis, which is the northern lights, can be quite severe and extensive because such activities have quite an influence on ionospheric densities. Severe sunspot activity or aurora discharges can cause complete radio blackouts over a wide range, wide frequency range, and over a great percentage of the Earth's surface. Scatter propagation, however, is not affected by the auroras. This is one reason why it is used, especially at high latitudes. And that's not altitudes, it's latitudes, high latitudes. High ionospheric densities will result in almost complete absorption of radiated signals. Even ionized trails produced by meteors entering the Earth's upper atmosphere can cause signal reflections. Okay. A lot to absorb there, guys. 5:30. That concludes this portion. We will continue with UHF and VHF propagation next time. And I'm sure everybody's scratching their head on this, but hopefully you got a little bit of insight on how these waves travel and what they do and how they work and how we use them and so on. So with that, thank you again for letting me have my corner. I'm going to go back into my corner. Roy, back to you. Thank you. WHCDL.
AC2GS, thank you very much, Andy. Andy's Corner, another episode, and next Sunday the adventure continues, so I thank you very much, and I hope everyone enjoyed the presentation. I just want to put a little addendum to a question asked by Juan Carlos, JC, KC2TJC. He was asking about FL Digi. I did a little bit further digging. There is something called Reed-Solomon identification of different modes. That's the good news. And also the good news is FL Digi is capable of detecting them and notifying you. The bad news is that I'm not quite sure if anyone actually uses it. And when they do use it, I notice that in FL Digi, there's a particular button that says RSID CQ. So I'm thinking that the people who actually use RSID use it once when they're making a random call for someone else. And if you miss that initial transmission, lots of luck because they don't send you an ID after that. So it's the answer for JC is yes, there is a way for FL Digi to figure it out, but most likely you're not going to see it happen.
WA2BDH with a quick comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to reference that article that Andy mentioned. The name of that article is A Binaural IQ Receiver. A Binaural IQ Receiver. It is in the March 1999 QST. Once again, that's a binaural IQ, like in-phase quadrature, receiver in March 1999 QST. And you're right, that's by KK7B.
Okay, very good. That's interesting. I'll have to pull out the archives of that. My Flex SDR, all it's capable of right now is just it has two separate receivers, it has two separate antenna inputs, so it can put the audio of one in one ear and the audio of the other in the other ear. There is an older version of a Flex radio called a 5000 and 3000 that uses different software that continues to be updated by a very obsessed software programmer, and he's able to incorporate phase distinctions in the two diverse signals and do a lot more interesting algorithms for diversity reception. So if you got a 3000 or a 5000, update your software and play with it.
Yeah, what's interesting about this one, it takes one antenna and then they demodulate it, they go through a mixer, two different mixers, and what they do is use a sine wave for one of the local oscillators and a cosine wave for the other local oscillator, so that's how they're getting their I and Q, and then they demodulate to the two separate signals and go to two separate, to a stereo headphone. So you have I in one ear and Q in the other. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm wondering if that really makes that much of a difference. Ultimately, you're just kind of delaying one signal by half the period of the signal. So, have you ever used anything like that? Any experience with that?
No, I have never played around with this at all. I know at school we do have a couple of vector signal generators that I played with, but looks like an interesting little project that I could build. It's not all that complicated, and he describes in the write-up that as signals will selectively fade, you can hear them sort of going between one ear and the other as the phase of the incoming signal changes, and you get more demodulation in one ear than the other. So I imagine it could cause some interesting effects, especially listening with stereo headphones. Go ahead.
Okay, so what they're doing is, in addition to the amplitude modulation, they're looking at the phase characteristics of the signal. So I guess that's interesting as well. I mean, almost all SDRs are based on manipulating the I and the Q signals. Those have to be combined with different algorithms in either a CPU or a field programmable gate array or something similar in order to just mathematically derive FM and single sideband and AM and CW, and all these modes can theoretically be totally demodulated at the level of the radio itself, if the software engineers were so inclined, using the I and the Q.
Yeah, it looks like an interesting little project. I remember Eric used to talk quite a bit about I and Q. He had quite a few interesting facts about it. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a quadrature delayed signal. They used to use something called a Taylor detector in early software-defined radios. To just right out of the front end decode it into both an I and a Q signal. The more expensive models these days doesn't do that. They just hook up the front end to a analog to digital, and they artificially create the quadrature component in the computer. Yes, Wesley.
Are we ready for science fiction?
We will eventually, but, you know, it's supposed to be the amateur radio technology, so when people still have ham radio technology questions, it takes precedence, at least as far as I perceive this. Little thing we do.
I agree with you.
Okay, very good. And once again, thank you to Andy for Andy's Corner, and I'm looking forward to next Sunday's installment. Next on my list is George, KD2Q, VCQ. What's your question for tonight, George?
Hello, Roy. Thank you. And I want to thank Paul for remembering that I was trying to call in. I'm sure you're aware I've been working with antennas over here and trying to figure things out. I'm in a situation with an HOA. In any event, I bought a Diamond HF-V5. It's a 6 to 40 meter trap dipole. I had it set up with the bracket mounted to a 1.5-inch PVC pipe that I slid over a grounding stake that I pounded into the ground and slid it over the stake so that it stood vertically. I had that sitting at the end of my deck where the support for the upper deck is. It never occurred to me, because I had great signal reception, but it never occurred to me. I couldn't transmit. I couldn't get out. There's actually a 4-inch steel pipe under the plastic support that actually supports the deck. It's not the plastic, it's the steel. And my antenna was about a foot away from it. I'm going to break for a second. So I thought I'd move it over. I moved it over to the other end of my deck, which is just about outside my door and about 5 feet away from the building. I put it on top. I had a 10 foot piece of PVC pipe that I mounted it to. So now it's 10 feet in the air, about 5 feet off my building. It's a trapped dipole, and I was getting good reception, as I said. When I moved it over, the noise level actually increased, and my signal level dropped to like 1 or 2. I've been playing with it during the call tonight while I was listening. I seem to have gotten it a little bit better. It could be I'm going through the manual page by page, but I'm trying to figure out what might be the problem.
Okay, that's a curious one. You gave it more elevation, and you put it farther away from your building, and you're picking up more noise. I mean, the obvious guess would be that there's something in that direction that's generating a lot more noise than was generating in the previous position.
That could be. I was thinking of moving it about 5 feet closer to the old position, but still away from the steel pipe. I actually removed the antenna today and put a 50-ohm dummy load on the input port of the antenna going into the radio, and I got absolutely zero noise, so I know it's something in the antenna. I'm thinking that maybe perhaps where I put it, there might be something in the wall there. But I'm wondering what I can do to, I mean, I'm not able to get out to anybody. I'm transmitting, but I don't know if anybody's receiving the signal. I don't know if I have enough power to break through these traffic jams. I'm not sure what the problem might be.
WP2AHK.
Yes, Chester.
Assuming that the bottom of the trap dipole is 10 feet up, that would be okay. But it's important to have your feed line, which is in the middle of the trap dipole, I assume, come out at right angles for a while. You can't have the feed line coming straight down against the antenna. Roy?
Okay, thank you very much, Chester. I think we're going to be confused a lot by the description of what's going on. My understanding, that antenna is really configured to sort of look like an inverted V. It has a post so that you can mount it with a vertical mast. But the actual thing is a shortened inverted V with traps and loading coils running at around a 45-degree angle off into the outer limits. So it's not as though this is truly a vertical, unless I'm wrong. It's that it's a shortened inverted V with lossy traps that's mounted on top of a vertical pole. Is that a good description of this thing, George?
That's a perfect description of it, sure. And it has two swivels. There's a bracket with two swivels that you mount the dipole elements into, and it has the trap at the end, the loading coils at the end. What he's saying now, there's a ballon in the middle, and that ballon has the coax connector at the bottom, and this whole bracket gets mounted vertically, and it is an inverted V. It looks like an inverted V at about a 35 to 40 degree angle. The cable, the way it's aligned, the cable should come straight out. Are you saying I should put a right angle in that?
I mean, I'll get back to Chester and ask him his opinion, but I think he misunderstood and thought that it was something like a vertical dipole. And so with a vertical dipole, you don't want your transmission line to be right up against and parallel to one of the legs of your dipole. But that's not what's going on. The only thing that your coax cable is next to is a support mast. But I'll throw it over to Chester and ask him if he agrees.
Well, I just assumed that this is like a dipole, and it would extend the left and the right-hand sides out in the air with two supports, and then coming down would be the feed line. And so that's what I assumed it was. So I was saying that if you had a 10-foot section of PVC pipe, and the one end of the antenna starts at the top of that 10-foot, and then he would raise the other part up in the air, there would then be a piece of coax in the middle, but Roy, you're saying something about the feed lines at the bottom, so I don't understand that. But the next thing I would like to say is that if you reorientate a antenna that's normally horizontally polarized and you make it a vertical polarized antenna, you tend to pick up more noise than a horizontal antenna. Roy?
Yeah, I would agree. Again, unfortunately, I think really the definition of what he's using is an inverted V. So an inverted V is one of those neither fish nor fowl. They have a little bit of both components, horizontal and vertical. But, you know, think of this antenna of George's as a inverted V with just a mounting pole in the center going down. So it would be look like a Y, but the bottom leg would be not electrically connected to the antenna, radiating antenna.
You said it got me confused, but at any rate, you seem to be doing the right thing. Well, let me ask him a question. Is there a feed line going to the middle of this antenna? If you hooked it up as an inverted V, with a feed line coming up to the middle and then two ends hanging down, even though it has traps, the traps are not important. Is there a feed line going to the middle, sir?
You're looking broadside to the antenna. It looks like the letter Y, with the two elements forming the top part of the Y and the coax forming the base of the Y. So the cable comes up and then it splits out left and right in to form a Y. Let me ask you a question. Instead of attaching this to PVC, should I be attached to the steel pipe? Be a connection with the ground?
Okay, before Chester answers his part, I just want to make it a little clearer. It's not really an inverted V. It's a real V. So it's two spokes going up at around 45 degrees with a mounting collar at the center and the feed point, and then whatever you have as a mast is supporting it from the ground. So the mast is not conducting. It's a V-shaped dipole. Unfortunately, it's not the greatest design I could think of for a bunch of reasons. People prefer inverted Vs because a lot more of the radiation occurs towards the area where the center feed is, and you want that as high as possible. So in this design, it's as low as possible. And you also tend to want to have a mechanically long dipole leg. When you shorten it, you decrease the radiation resistance, you decrease the efficiency, and you decrease the bandwidth. So there's a lot of compromises going on, but I'll throw it over to Chester if he has any comments.
Well, I don't know why you need... the PVC he's talking about, and he mentioned, should I not use the PVC and use a pipe? The important thing to me would be that the antenna would not want to be... He has the antenna in a vertical position now, instead of kind of horizontal, like a V, upside down V. He needs to have the bottom of the left-hand side of the V needs to be up as high as he can above ground, and the top part should hang away from the building as much as possible, maybe put the PVC off the rain gutter or something and make the antenna stand away from the house. That would have to be insulated from the rain gutter, so maybe a 5 foot sticking out from the rain gutter and then hang the antenna down from there. But the feed line, as best as possible, should be coming at a right angle as far as it can go, even 5 to 7 feet or something, but it should be coming out a perpendicular effect to the antenna. If you have your feed line hanging down against the element itself, I think the feed line is going to become, unless there's a balance or something, but the feed line is going to become part of the transmitting antenna. It's going to couple. So that's not good. Over.
Yeah, but again, Chester, this is not an inverted V. This is a regular letter V. So the center feed has the coax cable. It's draped down to a PVC pipe, and that's it. The legs of this antenna are going off like the letter V in opposite directions, with the coax dangling below the place where the V intersects itself down a PVC pole.
That's correct. And where the two holders, where the V comes together, the two element holders, just below that is a ballon. And the coax, the element attached to the ballon, and then the coax gets attached to the bottom of that, pointed toward the ground.
I mean, should have happened. Okay, I think this is more like a G5RV type antenna if the ballon is down at the other end. So I think it's more acting more like a G5RV broadcast.
As not a big fan of G5RVs, I think it's unfortunately worse than a G5RV. G5RVs have modes where they operate pretty much as a full mechanical dipole. This is neither this nor that. This is a V that's going in the wrong direction. Instead of being inverted, it's non-inverted. Instead of being mechanically quarter wavelength, it's shortened and it has lossy traps and it has loading coils. My big question to George, the million dollar question is, have you checked its standing wave ratio?
Yes, I have. It's 1.2 to 1.5 at right in the middle of each band. I'm running it to an automatic tuner. So the tuner, when I set up the SWR on my radio, the SWR on the radio, as I go through the frequencies, it's running about 1 to 1.3 on the SWR meter on the radio.
Okay, that's a very good thing. But then that what comes into play is what I often try to remind people, that life does not begin and end with your standing wave ratio. It's important to have a decent impedance match so that you minimize the reflection and transmission line losses and such. But it's also the electrical efficiency of the antenna. And if your antenna has its most of its transmission power at the lowest location and lossy inductors and traps, you might have a relatively low efficiency antenna, unfortunately, which, you know, most people, when they buy compromises like this particular model, it's kind of built into the whole thing. Ultimately, the higher you theoretically place it and the farthest away that you can manipulate it from your building, theoretically, the better it goes. You don't need to get a metal mast, PVC, if it structurally, mechanically supports it, is fine. You may have to play around with the position because you might have a local RF source that you're not aware of. You know, someone might have a fluorescent light with a faulty ballast in the apartment above you or to the side of you or something else that's going on. There might be neon signs nearby. So it's likely that it's a combination of not an extremely efficient antenna and also some local noise that's kind of interacting with your situation.
And it's chewing out Jay.
Yes, Sam.
And Roy, you hit it on the head. I have a friend that lives in a garden apartment here in Baldwin. 10 feet is not high for an antenna, because most of the people's roofs are 12, okay? And his place is like this guy's place. And he was getting the noise also, because 10 feet is not big. Even, like you said, you got to get it up higher, So what we were doing with it was turning it until we didn't hear the noise. With the bee, sometimes you pick up noise from another person's apartment. So as you turn it, you key it up, and then you see, you know, just like if you walk around a room with the handheld, you find the right spot.
Thank you, Sam. Yeah, I mean, to a degree, even a V dipole has a slight gain of about 2.15 decibels in one particular direction as opposed to 90 degrees from it. So you might benefit from a little rotation. It's certainly worth experimenting. And as Sam mentioned, and I mentioned a few weeks ago, that you really can't think of this as a complete vertical. It's mostly a horizontally operating antenna. And so what I said before kind of still goes, that theoretically you would want the center portion of that antenna to be a half of a wavelength distance from the ground, which in the case of 40 operating 40 meters, half would be 20 meters, that's 60 feet, that's six times the height it probably is. So for the higher bands, you might be able to get away with things, but because the center feed is the lowest portion of this type of antenna, it's more important than if it was an inverted V, in which people kind of shove the center portion as high up as they can. And since most of the radiation occurs in the region of the center feed, that's more effective than the way it's configured presently. So, but that's the design of the antenna. So as Sam said, as high as you could make it, and in addition to moving it around, you might want to try to twirl the legs a little bit at odd angles and see if that helps.
One follow-up quick question. What if I could probably, looking at it, I could probably take the ballon and flip it maybe to the other side of the mounting bracket in the opposite direction, where I could then take the entire antenna and flip it upside down. The elements would be on one side of the metal plate, the ballon would be on the other side of the metal plate, and then I could run it with the coax maybe down the center of the PVC. That way it would be more inverted V. Do you think that would help?
Okay. The problem with that, unfortunately, is that that's not going to change the elevation of the center feed at all. All that does is bring the legs even farther down, which is not great, but it's not as important as the center feed. But the most important part is the center feed, and by inverting it the way that you mentioned, you would indeed have a proper inverted V configuration, but the height of the center, which is the important part, it will be not any higher than it is presently.
Right, it would be 10 feet, so it doesn't matter whether it's up or down, as long as it's the height, the 10 feet, so it wouldn't matter if I swapped it that way or not. It's just maybe turning it through maybe 90 degrees and seeing if the noise ratio drops. The thing that just was curious to me is that the signal dropped down. I mean, I've had the noise ratio even where it was before. It was about the same noise ratio. It's just that the signal is like a 1 or a 2, where before I would say it was at least a 7 to a 9.
Well, I mean, it could be a very directional signal, and rotating the axis could, I guess, have an effect. It might be some weird response to reflecting off of your building. That's also a possibility. So in some cases, it constructively reflects off your building, and other cases, it doesn't. Yes, UDU.
Yes, George, are you saying that the noise got quieter when you moved your... when you moved the antenna, you had a higher noise level before? It sounds like moving it was better for you.
Actually had the same, the noise level seems about the same. The signal level seems like it's gone from like a 7 to 9 down to like a 1 or 2. It's like somehow I lost gain. While I was on the call tonight listening to Andy speak, I was kind of playing around and reading through the manual and everything, and I turned the attenuator on, and that seemed to help a little bit, but it's still, I'm not, for some reason, I'm not able to pull the signal in as powerfully as I